Hey, this is Jesse. In the fridge. We're in Michigan City, about to have some breakfast. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Jesse. Enjoy that delicious breakfast in beautiful Michigan City. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 955, and what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio, so hello to Bob, and it is wonderful to be here with you today. Happy February. We've got a good show lined up for you today. We hear from the CEO of a local community organization that works to reduce the rate of recidivism in the prison system. And the future of electric vehicles in Illinois is uncertain because of decisions made in Washington, D.C. We learn more about that issue. And oh my goodness, what is going on in Washington? What a week. President Trump froze federal funding, and that sent so many of us into chaos. I saw the impacts of this firsthand. In planning a show each week, I'm reaching out to a lot of nonprofit organizations who are doing important work for our local community. And a lot of these groups do receive federal dollars to carry out their missions. This week, everyone I was in contact with was terrified that the future of their organization was in jeopardy. The order to freeze federal spending was rescinded on Wednesday, and it looks like there are a few lawsuits pending about this. Who knows where all of this is headed? It looks like this kind of thing is what we're going to be seeing over the next 4 years, and it's only week two of this new administration. And moves like the one Trump made this week are at best political stunts and at worst just mean. Making moves in the name of cleaning up the government that gut the government and impede it from doing its job effectively hurts people. Some of the same people that voted for Trump, too. According to Governor Pritzker's office, this week, state programs experienced problems. Programs like Medicaid, temporary assistance for needy families, child welfare, senior health insurance, and the list goes on. That doesn't seem too populist to me. And for all the talk of ending the weaponization of government, it sure seems like the president is using the government as a weapon to get what he wants. This isn't some abstract battle of ideologies. It's about whether people in Illinois can afford rent, put food on the table, and get to work. It's about whether our economy keeps moving or grinds to a halt. It's about being able to live our lives to the fullest. So, speaking of living life to the fullest, do you have a gift closet? Because Mayor Johnson does. According to a report out this week, there is a room in City Hall, like an actual room, with things like designer bags, cufflinks, shoes, jerseys, and even whiskey in it. And these items were all gifts to the mayor. Apparently, a report from the Chicago Office of the Inspector General says that there is an unwritten agreement dating back to 1989 allowing city mayors to skip reporting gifts to the Board of Ethics and instead simply write them in a public logbook on the fifth floor of City Hall. What? I mean, I guess this isn't the biggest deal in the grand scheme of things, but who thought it was a good idea to use the honor system for the mayor of Chicago to self-report gifts received? Amazing. So hunker down in your windowless gift rooms. Here we go with the show. This week was pretty chaotic with news out of Washington, D.C. that the Trump administration froze federal spending. Then it was challenged in court and then, of course, rescinded. And who knows where it's at now. However, there was another spending freeze on day one of the new administration. This one deals with clean energy projects funded under the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. This could impact Illinois' goal of 1 million electric vehicles on the road by the year 2030. Brian Urbashevsky is the director of environmental health programs at the Respiratory Health Association. That's a Chicago-based nonprofit working to prevent lung disease and to promote clean air. And Brian is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Brian, welcome to the show. Just one or two things going on this week, man.
You said it.
So thanks for joining us today. Let's talk about your organization, something that we know firmly about here. Your organization, it's been around for a long time, over 100 years. Give us a little bit of the backstory about why the Respiratory Health Association exists.
Sure. Actually, you know, we go way back. We were founded in 1906 to fight lung disease. And back then, that was primarily tuberculosis, or what they called the White Death back then, which is interestingly getting a revival in Kansas this week. We've got the largest outbreak of tuberculosis in the last several decades, I think, going on in Kansas right now. But over the years, we've changed and added to more lung disease elements. And today, you know, like you said, our mission is prevent lung disease, promote clean air, and help people live better through education, research, and policy change. So that means we run a variety of programs focused on things like tobacco cessation, helping people quit, school programs focused on asthma and vaping. We do educational events for people with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. We fund health and medical research, and we support lung health and clean air policies while helping to stop, you know, provisions that would harm the lungs. And that's sort of our plate of activity. For myself, you know, we've been, you know, in the environmental arena, the clean air arena, we've been working on electrifying transportation and supporting clean, renewable power efforts for the last several years. And that way we basically get more electric, clean vehicles on the roads without tailpipes. And they're also being charged by zero emission electricity from solar and wind generated electricity that doesn't add to pollution. So it's a twofer.
Yes, it is. And so a lot of really great programs and initiatives that you are a part of at the Respiratory Health Association. So specifically, tell us about the goal for Illinois here, about how having 1 million electric vehicles on the road would benefit all of us going forward.
Well, getting 1 million electric vehicles on the road would, of course, you know, help reduce the tailpipe emissions that come out of vehicles. And that's a big goal for us locally, because those pollutants trigger asthma attacks, heart attacks, increase respiratory hospitalizations, you know, more doctor visits, more medication usage. And unfortunately, you know, some of the pollution that comes out of the tailpipe of cars and trucks as well can kill you. So it increases the number of premature deaths. So the more electric vehicles we can get on the road that don't increase the local air pollution burden is what we're aiming for. And in terms of like what the state's goals are right now, that goes back to, you know, around 2021, when the Clean and Equitable Jobs Act was passed in Illinois, that set 1 million electric vehicles by 2030 as the goal for the state. But to be honest, you know, that's like about, you know, 14% of the cars out there by 2030, which is pretty modest. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't say anything about, you know, past 2030 either. And the state is also committed to following through on the commitments of the Paris Climate Agreement and to reach those goals to cut global warming pollution. And, you know, honestly, we're supposed to be cutting about 43% by 2030 to reach that. So we really need to be doing more. And 1 million is pretty modest and is only a step towards what we really need to do.
Yeah, it sounds that way. So in terms of what the state's doing here, I know the state was counting on about $148 million for some electric vehicle infrastructure, things like chargers, because those are important as these cars are basically running on rechargeable batteries. And so the impact here of pausing this federal money for, you know, climate initiatives, environmental initiatives, can you explain the impact of doing that and what's going to happen here with the goals, the hopefully the goals that we have here in the state of Illinois?
That's a $20,000 question. you know, it's obviously it's not going to be helpful for what we're trying to do, what the state is already committed to do, and for what it needs to do going forward beyond 2030 as well. That, you know, that's going to throw a wrench in the works. And right now, there's a lot of people trying to figure out what's going on in terms of, you know, how much of that money does the state have in its own accounts right now that it can spend going forward, or permission to spend it, versus how much, you know, is potentially going to disappear and be, you know, cut off by the federal government. And that gets into a pretty murky, complicated legal situation, which I'm not an expert in. And it's going to take a long time, I think, to like see what happens when the smoke clears, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But, you know, most of this money has already, you know, been in approved awards to the state from the federal government. The state has also been spending its own money through various provisions and various accounts. And it just is unclear at this point, like how much of this money is going to wind up on the ground and how fast that's going to happen. And it's a lot of money. I mean, it's actually more like about $175 million. That is kind of, you know, in question right now, that could be used to build more electric vehicle charging stations for things like cars. But there's also about $300 million, a little more than $300 million, for truck and freight electrification projects as well. So this is a big question as to what's going to happen with all this money.
So, you know, the way I look at it here, and I've talked about issues of the environment many times over the years here on this show, and I've brought up the tension that exists between, you know, the business, you know, industry and environmental issues. And what I thought was kind of cool about what these bills that were passed in the Biden administration era, what they did is, hey, look, it's not like we want to get rid of people's jobs, but maybe we need to change the industry a little bit to adapt to this new kind of technology that's cleaner, that can benefit really all of us here when we're talking about our health. And so I feel like sometimes, especially recently, that messaging has gotten lost. And it's about like, well, it's this liberal green stuff and it's, you know, who cares? It's a waste of money and that's going to hurt jobs. But what we're saying here, I mean, especially in the state of Illinois, I think we've made really some conscious decisions and steps in a direction to say we can preserve jobs, we can make jobs, but maybe the technology has to change. And I think sometimes we lose that in the messaging. Is that something you're trying to get across here?
Oh, of course. And, you know, just to pull way back on this, I mean, there's a fun fact I learned this week, and it's that for about 45-46% of new vehicles being sold in China this past year were electric.
Hmm. Wow.
That should really make people think.
Yeah.
And China is doing really good at making electric cars. They want to sell them in South America. They want to sell them in Mexico. They want to sell them in the European Union and in Canada. They want to sell. And so that's what we're kind of competing with on a global marketplace. And it's just so frustrating because literally billions of dollars have been sunk into the American auto industry to prepare for electric vehicles and to start producing them over the past 5, 6, 7 years. And to sort of like have this confusion being sowed and sort of, you know, all these barriers being put in the way of the industry is just going to end badly, I believe. And it's just so frustrating because like batteries have gotten so much cheaper over the last several years. They've dropped about 90% over a 10-year period, which is the major cost of, you know, electric vehicles. And the first electric vehicles were like, you know, fancy, you know, luxury cars. But we're getting more to things like the Chevy Equinox, which is, you know, it's your ordinary suburban, you know, soccer kid car.
Right.
You know, 300-mile range. About $30,000 as a starting point. And you're seeing more pickups and minivans and other sedans that are starting to show up. It's just, you know, we're such on the cusp of like having a really vigorous American electric automobile industry that provides those good jobs. And then you have these really confusing and counterintuitive edicts coming from the new administration in Washington, D.C. I mean, just for Illinois, you think about a company called Rivian, which not a lot of people have heard about, but they make SUVs and pickup trucks, all electric.
Mm-hmm.
They also make Amazon delivery vehicles, those big package vans. And they've, you know, made tens of thousands of these vehicles, over 50,000 vehicles, I think, in the past year. at a factory in Bloomington Normal, Illinois, downstate, you know, between Chicago and Springfield.
Sure.
It's a factory that was literally abandoned and they were going to wreck it. And this company bought it 8 years ago. It now employs 7,000 people.
Wow.
And they got money to expand that factory last year, and they're going to make more models going forward over the next 2 years. So it's stuff like that that's really being put at risk, apart from the health impacts, of course, of, like, you know, adding more gasoline tailpipes and burning more oil and gasoline on roadways, you know, and affecting people's lungs. It's aiming to destroy new industries that we're going to need to compete on the global stage with.
Yeah. And it's not like we're not producing fossil fuels. I know the United States is just cranking out a bunch of fossil fuel production here in oil, and we're leading the world with that right now. So, you know, to say, and I've heard this, it's come from the new administration, we're in this energy emergency. I don't quite see that. I mean, what I see here is this environmental emergency that we're in. So I want to ask you, where do we go? I mean, where do we go from here? I mean, I feel like we're, you know, we're in what, week two of this administration, and boy, we've got 4 more years of this. So what's the path forward here, Brian?
You know, there's going to be a lot of legal fights going forth. And like I said, it may take a long time to figure out what happens with all this federal funding and what actually comes through. In the meantime, the state really does need to double down, you know, for the health of its own residents, if not the economic factors that we talked about. And, you know, we're working with a lot of other groups that are pushing Illinois to adopt cleaner vehicle standards that California initially authored, that about a dozen or so other states have adopted, that would accelerate the number of electric vehicles sold in Illinois over the next 10 to 15 years. There's a California rule that says by 2035, all new vehicles would have to be zero emission. So anything you sell starting in 2035 would have to be, you know, an electric or something that didn't add to the local air pollution burden. That's something that Illinois really needs to do. It needs to join with states like, you know, Washington State and California, Oregon, New York, New Jersey, a bunch of other states that are saying, you know, for the health reasons of our residents and for the threat that we still see, despite the Trump administration, of accelerating global warming causing lots of health and not to mention property damage, we need to go forward with the electric revolution and, you know, continue to invest and go in that path. You know, I'm in favor of that because I see that as, you know, preventing asthma attacks, you know, preventing people winding up in the hospital from air pollution as we get more clean vehicles on the road. But, you know, other folks are working on that because they see the dangers of global warming. And, you know, we've seen the floods, you know, we've seen the, you know, the heat waves, we've seen the fires here in Chicago that were actually in Canada. You know, right. 2 years ago, we had the worst air quality in the world in Chicago because of fires that were hundreds of miles away in central Canada being driven by global warming because it was hotter and drier than it should have been in Canada. And, you know, that those types of things are only going to continue and accelerate unless we take a serious path towards eliminating the problem by, you know, going towards an electric transportation system.
All right. Well, we've got some work to do. That is for sure. So the work continues, and we could check out the great work of the Respiratory Health Association online, RESPHealth.org. Brian Urbashevsky is the Director of Environmental Health Programs at the Respiratory Health Association, talking to us about the roller coaster that is now and the effort to get as many electric vehicles on the road in Illinois as possible to protect our health. Hey, Brian, I appreciate the time today. Thanks for talking to us and best of luck going forward, man.
Thanks, Mike, and best of luck to all of us going forward.
Want to see the crime rate in Chicago decrease. And one way that could happen is to reduce the amount of repeat offenders. This isn't easy to do since many times those who come out of incarceration fall back into the same criminal behaviors that got them into the justice system in the first place. The Lawndale Christian Legal Center is a North Lawndale-based nonprofit that provides support for those who are incarcerated, free legal services, and social services for the community. They are expanding this year by building a new restorative justice hub. They are online at lclc.net, and Cliff Nellis is the president and CEO of the Lawndale Christian Legal Center. He is back with us here on Outside the Loop. Cliff, nice to talk to you again, man. How are you?
Yeah, good to talk to you again too, Mike. Thanks for having me.
You got it. So let's talk a little bit about North Lawndale. We've talked about this before, but a community like North Lawndale, you know, has this history of disinvestment and neglect, and it's got, I think the statistic was about 20% unemployment, which is huge. 12% of all Illinois prisoners are from that neighborhood. Give us a sense of how unique the situation is in this area in Chicago and really the needs specifically of that community.
Yeah, it's a good question, Mike. I mean, the reality is that many of our young people in North Lawndale are growing up in survival mode, right? They lack sometimes basic things such as housing. They have a hard time getting to and from school because they don't have transportation. Maybe their families or themselves, they don't have any income. And so oftentimes it's literally empty refrigerators, food, rent, utilities. And so a lot of young people, more than I think most people probably believe or recognize, are growing up on the streets at early ages trying to make ends meet. And that, of course, creates kind of a cycle of poverty, cycle of crime, cycle of violence. You know, it doesn't take long for you to be on the streets before you're starting to make money through illegal ways.
Right. And, you know, I think it's not like people love doing this criminal behavior. I think sometimes we assume the worst when we see media reports and we read the headlines or just watch the evening news. You know, it's like, oh, these folks must enjoy going out and doing these awful things. And really what we're talking about here is, and what you're saying is, sometimes this criminal behavior manifests out of necessity. Like, people need to steal to make money in order to live. And so we want to keep that in mind. I think there's a lot of stereotyping also that goes on here just by the bits and pieces that we get about areas like North Lawndale.
Yeah, it's 100% correct. I think most people not from here do make those assumptions. And the truth is that once you get to know the young people and their circumstances and their lives, one, it's not hard to understand why they're doing what they're doing. I think any of us would be doing it. And two, it's also then not hard to see that, hey, listen, you give these kids some support, you give them some housing, some workforce development, you give them some quality legal representation, you get them through this criminal justice system and away from it, they'll never go back to it if you give them some opportunities for a better future.
And again, this kind of shared humanity that we have, I think that's something that's lost too. And I've talked about it many times in this program, and I kind of look at this and, yeah, nobody likes the crime, right? It's unsettling, it's disturbing, it's scary. But when you think about what's happening in these folks' lives, right, and happening just on a day-to-day basis, and to understand that just like me, just like you, just like everyone listening, they want a better life for themselves, and this is unfortunately the way that they have to go about that. But let's not lose sight of the fact that folks are looking for a good life, and we have a lot in common here. Like, we want good things. We want good families to be loved and to love people. But that's something I think sometimes we forget, you know?
Yeah, 100% for sure. And completely agree. I mean, it is kind of a basic desire that we all share, right? We all want to be safe. We all want to have what we need to provide for not only ourselves, but our families.
So at the Lawndale Christian Legal Center, you say that your approach to restoring community is a holistic approach. So let's talk about that right there. When you say it's a holistic approach, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, I can give you a very clear example, right? We're about a month away from opening up the Dr. Dennis Deere Community Justice Center. It's a $22.5 million facility. It'll be the new headquarters for all of our office, all of our staff, all of our services. But including space for our staff, it's also space for 20 units of studio-style housing that we're using for emerging adult men, 18 to 25-year-old, that we are representing. They're currently in the Circuit Court of Cook County facing felony charges. And instead of our incarceration, we're going to be asking state attorneys and judges to say, hey, let's give these young men a chance to come to the Deer Center where they'll have their own, you know, one person per unit, a studio style unit of housing where they have a kitchenette and a bathroom. They'll have workforce development on site. They'll have mental health services. We'll have restorative justice practices. And part of it is healing circles, and any victims or defendants that can or want to be part of that process, we can help facilitate that healing. But yeah, we're basically trying to address the underlying root causes of crime, sort of the behavior, the things that lead to our young people getting involved in the system in the first place. And housing, mental health, and workforce development are the top three for emerging adult men.
We'll talk about the restorative justice piece of this in a minute, but thinking about just the workforce development, right? The basic skills that maybe some of us take for granted, that maybe some of these folks just never had a chance to learn. So what you're saying here is you're going to get them into a situation where they can learn this, they can actually do these things for themselves, and in a way take control of their lives and not have the circumstances of where they live dictate how they turn out.
Absolutely. For most of our young people, this is their first chance, really. They haven't had, I mean, most of our young people are very familiar with being evicted and going couch surfing or living in a two bedroom with 10 people, right? This is going to be the first time oftentimes they even have their own bed, let alone their own apartment. It's a studio style. It's a little bit bigger than a dorm room. It's meant to mirror a college experience, but it's transitional supportive housing, right? We want to, while they're in our care, provide them with the workforce development training, job placement, mental health, so that, you know, while they're with us, they learn financial management, independent living skills. And then once they obtain that livable wage job, they can stay for 12 months, put a little nest egg aside, and then go out on their own, maybe put a down payment on a home or at least a deposit on a rental unit of their own. But yes, we want them to be able to live financially independent lives that where they get to pursue the career of their choosing and thrive just like all of us.
And I think it's important that we emphasize that, because a lot of times we think, oh, this is a handout, but it's not a handout as much as it is a hand up. I mean, you're empowering them to do things on their own. So it's not like, yes, you're providing some resources, but that's so they can take control and do this on their own one day.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's even just having their own place to lay their head down at night and just breathe, right? And just be able to think long term, because they're not scrambling to figure out where they're going to get their next rent check or their next meal. It allows them to think longer term, prepare longer term, and get the support they need to realize their potential. And you said it earlier, but our young people here in North Lawndale, like any young person anywhere, they have an abundance of potential. I mean, they're very entrepreneurial. They work hard. I mean, even street life is hard work, right? Yeah. I mean, it's no picnic. So we're trying to get them into, you know, something where they have, you know, legitimate means to make ends meet. And that's what the Deer Center is about.
Cliff, I want to come back to something that you mentioned before, and this idea of restorative justice, this practice. And so I think that's a term that maybe more and more folks are becoming familiar with or maybe have heard. But can you tell us what is restorative justice?
Yeah, you know, the best way to, I think, define what it is contrast it to maybe traditional criminal justice. So traditional criminal justice, you typically have laws with various classifications, right? A class X felony, class 1, 2, 3, 4. And those come with prescribed punishments, 6 to 30, 4 to 15, 3 to 7, 2 to 5, 1 to 3. And so the criminal justice system is kind of built on this model of you have laws and you break them, and then there's punishments that are prescribed for it. Restorative justice looks at relationships within the community and says, okay, these are two people that live in this community that they have now been harmed, right? There's actually been harm done to the community. And justice, the truest form of justice, would actually be to enable and empower those impacted by this to repair the harm that's done. So you're looking at broken relationships and healing those relationships. And so core restorative justice practices is to bring victims and defendants together and called a healing circle. And that is where it's a, you know, it's a lengthy process where you have some pre-work prior to sitting in circle, but you're the person who committed the harm is going to own and take responsibility for that, apologize. The victim is going to get, you know, a more meaningful personal apology and also an understanding of what happened and why. At the same time, of course, the person who committed the harm is going to face a more personal ownership of it, right? You're looking the person in the eye who you harmed. And it's an opportunity for social emotional growth on all around, really. And impacted community members and circle keepers that support that process, they support that process so that at the end, basically the last pass, if you will, when everybody goes around the circle, is kind of what does everybody in this space need to become whole? And the group gets to decide that. And once that's decided, then the group works together to complete whatever it is that the group has decided needs to happen for everybody in that space to become whole as a result of what transpired.
So this is a process, though. So it's not like something happens, someone commits a crime or hurts someone, and they go into a room the next day and someone apologizes and everyone's on their way. I mean, this is a serious process here that has to happen, and it doesn't happen overnight.
That's correct. Yeah. In fact, a lot of times people, in fact, I used to think this, to be honest, before I knew restorative justice and personally practiced.
You're a convert, aren't you?
I am a convert. I used to think it sounded like, you know, pretty ridiculous, to be honest.
Right, right.
It sounds pretty soft and mamby-pamby. But the truth is that, you know, it's actually much more personal. It's much more involved, right? I mean, it actually takes more time because you do have to spend time in reflection prior to coming to circle. And then, of course, circle can take, more than one circle, and one circle can easily take 2 hours. So, you know, and depending upon the severity of the harm, that can be a longer process. But, you know, this is also not theory either, right? We were the lead agency on the community side that partnered with the Circuit Court of Cook County to design and launch the first restorative justice community court in the country right here in North Lawndale. And now there's four others that the chief judge has, you know, put up around the city, around the county. But, you know, we were instrumental in helping design and launch that court. And it's based upon these restorative justice practices. So it's alive and in practice. It's not just theory.
So what do you say to the criticism that, well, OK, people have to go through this process and they've committed crimes, but hey, they're not going to serve time or do very little time. Is there actual punishment? How do you respond to those criticisms?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that, you know, if we look at it from the lens of just, well, this deserves a punishment, then we're not necessarily looking at what's going to make us safer and stronger as a result. We're not helping necessarily the victim in this situation who very rarely gets restitution or is made whole. And we're certainly not helping the defendant learn and grow through this because, you know, the alternative would be, of course, a permanent felony record and maybe some incarceration. Whereas instead, restorative justice allows you to actually understand the people in that space, understand, including the defendant, like what was going on in that young person's life. And as we already said, there's usually a lot of things that are like, okay, this isn't hard to connect the dots here. Why don't we start to focus on addressing some of those needs? Because if we can address those needs, then this isn't going to happen again. And so if you really want to make, you know, communities safer and stronger, it seems now to me, you know, 15 years down the road after doing this now, it's like, how could we not think that justice in its truest form is healing and repairing harm done to the people most impacted, including the defendant who may have committed the harm and was yesterday's victim that needs his own or her own healing.
Right. So what we're saying here is that those who commit crimes and go through this restorative justice process, it's not like they're not doing anything. And you mentioned that there are these circles and quite literally, I mean, people are sitting in a circle and there are times when certain folks can talk and they are looking at each other eye to eye, telling each other, you know, the what happened and how the feelings are evoked from the events that transpired and why they transpired in that way. But then I guess where you come in with the Lawndale Christian Legal Center is you say, okay, understanding where this person who committed a crime is at, how do we get them to be better? And that's where your services come in.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you address those underlying root causes of behavior, the social determinants of health, the things that we all need to thrive, then yes, young people are going to take advantage of that. They want a better life, just like everybody else. And we spoke about that earlier, that, you know, all of us have that sort of innate desire to be safe and to be able to provide for ourselves and our families. And that's what we're doing. We're giving them that opportunity.
Right. And if people really want a safer community, I mean, the justice system as it currently exists, that punishment doesn't always act as a deterrent and often can break people when they come out. They're no better off than when they came in to the justice system. Maybe they're a little worse. And like I said before, they get back into the same things that got them into the justice system in the first place. So what we're saying here is if we can make a correction, life skills, job skills, that's going to really change the face of the community. So Cliff, what's been the impact of you doing this work so far? Do you have any data that you can tell us?
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at about any given year, somewhere between 75 to 82% of the young people that we're serving are not catching new cases or not getting or, you know, leaving the justice system and not returning. In the restorative justice community court, the data there was there was a report published by the Circuit Court of Cook County, and it was 87% success rate.
Wow.
I mean, you can't compare that to, you know, like traditional recidivism rates. In fact, a control group that was pulled from 26 in California, where same charges, same ages, same everything, they had the 65% recidivism. So, you know, it's a stark, you know, 35 success versus 87. And so, or 13 recidivism versus 65. So it works, right? We know that. And particularly for young people who are in developmental phases of life, right? Not just minors 17 and under, but 18 to 25. They're coming out of a childhood and for the first time entering adult as an independent person, right? And that's a tough thing to do if you didn't have the things, you know, school and support, and you don't have, you know, money for a college education, or you know, you've been, you know, basically been surviving up until that point. Now you're on your own. It's like, well, you know, we need to help those young men and women be able to find their place in the workforce and secure, you know, stable housing for themselves and their families and thrive. And we can do that. We can do it. It just is. It's an investment in our young people that has a long term benefit to all of us.
And this new restorative justice hub that you are building, it will be done later this year. I mean, that's really going to be the centerpiece kind of what you're doing here to get folks really on the right path. And it sounds like that is going to be the next step for everything we're talking about here, what with the restorative justice court in Cook County. And really, this what is about to happen here, this is exciting. I mean, some good news in a very chaotic time, I feel like. This is going to help out a bunch of people.
Yeah, it is. It's a light right now in the darkness. So it feels good. We're really excited. We're actually going to be opening and moving staff in March and residents in April. So, I mean, it's coming. We're a month or two away from moving in, and grand opening is on our grand opening celebrations on Sunday, April 27th. Hope to see you there. Would love to have you come, but it's just going to be a street festival and a party with a bunch of tours and live entertainment. So, yeah, we're excited. It's definitely a big moment, and we think that it's a national model for how to keep young people in community with supports instead of sending them to prison and saddling them with permanent criminal records.
This is wonderful work and certainly a light in a chaotic time for sure. And we can all check out the website for the Lawndale Christian Legal Center, lclc.net. Cliff Nellis, the president and CEO of the Lawndale Christian Legal Center, based in the North Lawndale neighborhood, a wonderful nonprofit organization doing some amazing work in Chicago. Hey, Cliff, it's always a pleasure speaking with you. Congratulations on all of your success. Thanks for all of your hard work, and we'll talk again for sure.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, Mike. It's good to talk to you.
And that will do it. Outside the Loop show number 955 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his wonderful engineering skills in the WGN Radio studio. I hope you have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time. In these crazy times, you're on Outside the Loop.